page 8, and we're down under number C. Some of this is going to be repetition from last week here under number C. Talking about, just kind of focusing on some of the certain activities that went on during these times. And so if you go back to Genesis chapter 6, we're looking here at these three key events: Noah's flood, Tower of Babel, and Sodom and Gomorrah. Basically learning about, looking at them as representative of God's intervention in nations or large groups of people at different times. And so in Genesis chapter 6, we'll begin reading at verse 1. And it says in verse 1, "Now it came about when men began to multiply in the face of the land and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful. They took wives for themselves, whomever they chose. Then the Lord said, My spirit shall not always strive or deem judge with man forever, because he is also flesh. Nevertheless, his days shall be 120 years. The Nephilim, or the fallen ones, were on the earth in those days and also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore them children. They were mighty men, and they were men of renown," or they were famous. And then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the day. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart." And then it goes on and it says in verse, let's look at verse 7. It says, "And the Lord said, I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the earth, from man to animals." Now this is important that it says that he's going to blot them all out in there. And then it also tells us in verse 8, "But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord." And verse 9, these are the generations of Noah. Now, it doesn't give a genealogy, but it says these are his generations. Noah was righteous, and he was unblemished or clean in his time or in his generation. Noah walked with God. So in other words, unlike these people, in his genealogy, Noah was not, he was not involved in everything else that was going on. But then he says in verse, verse 10, we have him and his children. And verse 11 says, "Now the earth was corrupt in the sight of God. The earth was filled with violence. And the Lord looked on the earth, and behold, it was corrupt. For," and this is important now, "for all flesh had corrupted their way upon the earth." So it's not just humankind, but this is why God in the ark destroys all these things that has the breath of life in them, not just mankind. See, when Sodom and Gomorrah, he wipes out a city. Babel, he scatters the people. The flood, he takes out everybody, because everybody is involved in this. And this is important for us understanding that everybody, and even these creatures at this time, are all involved in this corruption. And we've talked about before, and I don't want to get into a lot of speculation because we're trying to stick to the main big stories, but it's very possible at this time that this is where we ended up some of the bizarre creatures that have ended up in mythology, and some of the bizarre creatures that end up in the fossil records that may have come out of all this stuff that was going on at this time. And I would find it interesting. We are wildly fascinated as people with these strange creatures, both mythological. Mythology is only a way of describing something that you don't have evidence actually exists. They call the Bible mythology if you're secular people all the time, because they don't think there's evidence that it exists. But some of that stuff may have existed. And we're wildly fascinated with that, and we're wildly fascinated with dinosaurs and things of that nature. And yet all of these things may have fallen in here. So God intervenes, because humanity is as a total involved in this, as well as all creatures. Okay. Now we're going from there over to Genesis chapter 11. Genesis chapter 11, which we, again, this is kind of reviewing, but if you remember what God had told Noah to do back in chapter 9, in fact, you should flip back over to chapter 9. We looked at this in one of our previous studies as a comparison to God's word to Adam and then God's word to Noah and his family. And he says in verse 7 of Genesis 9, "And as for you, be fruitful and multiply and populate the earth abundantly and multiply in it." So God has told these people to multiply in this way. And then you come to chapter 11, and having given them this instruction, their response in verse 4 is, "Come, let us build for ourselves a city, a tower whose top literally is in the heavens. And let us make for ourselves a name, lest we should be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth." In other words, the very thing God had told them, told Noah when they got off the ark, and he tells them to be fruitful and multiply and go out and fill the earth and go out there. They don't want to do that. They all want to stay in one location. Which again demonstrates the nature, we would say, of man's disobedience in these things. And so God makes the statement in verse 6 of Genesis chapter 11, the Lord said, "Behold, they are one people, they all have one language, and this is what they began to do. Now nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible for them," or nothing will be literally withheld. Now, could God stop it? Yeah, he's going to stop it right here, and he stops it at other times. But the point that God's making is, they're not going to think anything's off limits. That's literally what he's going to say, is what he's getting at. He's thinking, if we let them do this, they're going to think they can do anything. And this is really where mankind is at today. They have gone down this path. They have proceeded down this since that time where they, has mankind made cities since the days of Babel? Yeah, they've made cities. They've made cities that probably would put Babel to shame in terms of size, because they're so vast. And when you think of some of these size, what is that? I think the largest city in the earth Shanghai? Or is it Hong Kong? One of those cities that just vast, and it's just huge, and the population dwarfs everything else in the world. But this is what they do. And always when they make those cities, it's like, those people take pride in being from those cities. Now, you know, someone comes from New York, they're from New York. They can't believe how in the world you could live out here like this. That they just, because, like, everything revolves around life. I mean, I listened to a man on the radio last year that made the comment. He's from the city. He went to Iowa. And he says, the silence was almost deafening. He says, "I don't know how those people can, how you can live with no noise. It's just too quiet." You know, you live for all that. And he says, and then there's nothing to do out there. There's nothing to do. I mean, you don't have theaters to go to, you know. They wanted theaters, and they want to go out to eat every night at fancy restaurants, and they live this life, and everything revolves around life in the city. This whole mentality, that we're going to make a name for ourselves.
If you ask him, so how often do you go out?
I know.
They always say that.
But they don't do it that much. You'd go broke if you lived the kind of lifestyle a lot of these people think that they can live when they live in the city. But see, it's all about doing that. It's all about all the options that the city offers them. This is what they think. And this is what was happening with Babel. They developed this mentality that nothing's off limits to us. We don't want to do what God said. We're going to make a name for ourselves. And this is the way it went. And this is why God intervened there. And then in chapter 18, where we were last week of Genesis, chapter 18, with Sodom and Gomorrah. Genesis chapter 18, verse 20, and it said, 18:20, it says, "And the Lord said, the outcry of Sodom and Gomorrah is indeed as great. Their sin is exceedingly grave. I will go down now and see if they have done entirely according to its outcry." So God's going to come down. Now, again, we talked about this last week. Does God not know what's happening in Sodom? No, God certainly knows what's going on. But it's going to be what God's saying is, I'm going to show up. Are they going to act like this if I'm there? Are they going to act like this right there in my presence? Are they so obstinate in this? And then it goes on down in the context, if you remember, and what we found out in Noah's day at the flood, how many righteous persons were there? One that we know of, Noah. God saved eight. Oh, that's five. Eight. But Noah was the righteous one. Noah was the one that was actually the righteous individual. Now, maybe some of his sons were, but God doesn't say that his sons were righteous. Okay. So then we come here to Sodom and Gomorrah, and we have the situation where Abraham asks all this question about God. How about 50? How about 45? How about 40? And he gets all the way down to 10. And God says in verse 32, if there are 10, I will not destroy it on account of 10. God goes down there and destroys the city, meaning what? In this city, there's not 10. There's not even 10 righteous people. Go on down further, and I'm going to point out one other detail, and I don't think I have this on the next page. Don't have this on the next page. But when it talks about the violence of the people, most of us have in our minds certain things about what happens in here. But if you look in Genesis chapter 19, and it says in, let's just try to think where I want to put in here, because I didn't mark this verse on here. Lot goes out to these people. Oh, no, we need to back up. I'm sorry. Let's go down back up to verse 19. Now the two angels came to Sodom in the evening as Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom.
Verse 1,
what did I say?
19.
Oh.
So we're chapter 19.
It's chapter 19, verse 1. Thank you. Now the two angels came to Sodom in the evening as Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. And when Lot saw them, he rose to meet them and bowed down with his face to the ground. And he said, now behold, my lords, please turn aside into your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet, and then you may rise early and go on your way. And they said, however, no, but we will spend the night in the square. Now, why are they going to spend the night in the square? Why do they insist on spending the night in the square? Because I think they know the reputation of these cities. And going into Lot's house is going to hide the opportunity for them, for these people to prove their character. And yet he urged them strongly, because he knows the kind of people he lives among. So they turned aside to him, entered his house, and he prepared a feast for them, baked unleavened bread, and they ate. But before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, surrounded the house, both young and old, and all the people from every quarter. And they called to Lot and said to him, we are the men who came, or where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may know them or have relations with them. And Lot went out to them outside the door. And what ends up happening, and this is, there's two things that are going on here that we don't understand. One of the things that he was crying, that it was talking to us about back in chapter 18, is that the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah is a sin. It is very great. And then we also looked at last week that God looked at Sodom and Gomorrah as also being a very violent city. So we had both of these things. Now, most of us, the way I have tended to think about Sodom and Gomorrah is just to look at it primarily as such a horrible city that they're all homosexuals, which that may have been part of it. But that's not the only thing that's going on here. When these men of the city come round, what they have is they have guests that are coming around here. And they bring these guests in here, and I don't want to be overly graphic on this because you guys don't need the graphic details. But what they ask for and what they are trying to do is actually something that's a matter of dominating. That's what they're actually doing. This is a violent act that they're perpetrating to say, who is the boss? We're the boss. And this is the way we do it. If any of you are familiar with life in big, and I don't know how far you have to go into the prison system to get to this, but this is what happens in prisons. And it doesn't happen because of, well, there might be some inordinate affections and things like that, but the number one reason it happens is for people to say, I'm the boss, and you know I'm the boss because this is what I can do to you, and I can humiliate you by doing this. And this is what these men are trying, this is one of the things that these men are trying to do in this context. It's a violent act, is really what it is, okay? If you don't read this and understand that they're more than just asking, they're not just asking to have a friendly evening with these guys, obviously. I'm trying to put this euphemistically. They're really talking about rape. Isn't that what they're talking about? Just shows you again, these are violent people. And that again shows you, like the people in Noah's day, like the Tower of Babel, nothing can be withheld from them. Anything they want, they'll do. Or, like these people, all of them are about people that have reached a state of violence in their culture, a state of disregard for God, to the point that God stepped in. So this is what we've been trying to look at over the last couple weeks. So, pressing on then down there, if you turn over to the book of 2 Peter, there is an interesting statement that Peter makes in 2 Peter chapter 2. Second Peter chapter 2, and I want to go back to verse, there's actually a lot of things he says in here, so let's go back to verse 4, and we'll work down to the verse I want, which is verse 9. It says, "For if God did not spare the angels when they sinned," and he's not talking about angels in Satan's day, because it says he cast them into Tartarus, committed them into pits of darkness. He's looking at a time when these angels sin. Jude has a parallel passage, and Jude compares the sin of these angels to the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah. "And they did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a preacher of righteousness, with seven others, when he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly." Remember, when you look at this term ungodly, we talked about this every occurrence of this term ungodly that I've looked at, unless I'm not remembering them right, every one of them refers to works, people that are venting rather vociferously the works of the flesh. Verse 6, "And he condemned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to destruction by reducing them to ashes, having made them an example to those who would live, again, ungodly thereafter." Same kind of thing. They pursue this violent, unrestrained lifestyle, like they did in Noah's day, like the angels did. In fact, I'm going to say this because we're going to touch it in just a minute. And verse 7. "And if he rescued righteous Lot," notice it calls Lot righteous. See, I grew up in churches where a lot of times Abraham was always the good guy. Lot, his nephew, oh, he was the bad guy because he went and lived in Sodom. You know, that would be like if you chose to move into San Francisco. Well, that automatically means you must be a bad person if you chose to live in San Francisco because you're living in a bad place. Or if you chose to live in New York City, must be a bad person for that. But the Bible says he rescued righteous Lot, who by the sensual conduct of these unprincipled men, I'm reading out of my New American Standard, and I apologize, but it drives me nuts when I'm reading something and I want to know what the Greek words are behind it because I don't remember them. Thought it was sharp enough. So we have in here that righteous Lot was distressed by the lawless, and he actually says lewd conduct. Now, lewd conduct is a very strong word indicating that these people have no restraint and they're very public about it. Again, we find a lot of parallels in our modern culture, isn't it? I mean, it used to be. I'm not saying the things that go on today didn't go on 50 years ago or 100 years ago, but they were done someplace else. Now it's all public and we all have to talk about it and everybody has to know about it. And that's this idea of this word in here, this strength, their lewd conduct. But it says he was rescued. And then it goes on and says in verse 8, "For by what he saw and heard, this righteous man, while living among them, his righteous soul." Notice three times it says righteous, righteous, righteous. Three times. Like, is Peter trying to make a point that Lot was a righteous man? "His righteous soul," it tells us in verse 9, "was tormented." And that word tormented is actually like a word meaning to beat it up. It's like it's being thrashed about, beaten and smacked about day after day by their lawless deeds. Some people would say, well, if you really were that righteous, why don't you move? Why don't you leave, Lot? Well, God is going to take him out. God's going to rescue him out of there. Verse 9 is an important verse. "And the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from temptation and to keep the unrighteous under punishment for a day of judgment, especially those who indulge the flesh and its corrupt desires, despise authority, daring, self-will. They do not tremble when they revile angelic majesties." Now, and all of those things describe these people. What these people are doing, he says, first of all, they're indulging the flesh with its corrupt desires. So the first thing these people are doing is that they are being sexually immoral. But it goes beyond that. They have no respect for any authority. There's no, and Jude tells us exactly the same thing. They have no respect for authority whatsoever. And not only that, but they're very daring and self-willed. What did God say in the day with regard to Babel? Hey, if you don't stop this, there's not a thing that will be withheld from them. They're going to think they can do anything, which is exactly where everything ended up going anyway. And this is the nature. But God, important thing for us, the key verse I wanted to point out really is verse 9. The Lord knows how to rescue the godly out of temptation. In other words, when you as a believer find yourself embroiled, find yourself in situations where you're living among this and all this kind of stuff is going on and you're wondering, how do I do this? How do I handle this? How do I get out of this? You need to know that God knows how to rescue out of those things. Now, God may do something in the nature he did with Lot, where God may literally want you to move from this place to another location. That may be what God does. And he certainly did that with Lot. Because remember, there wasn't even 10 righteous people in that city. But that's not always the way God rescues a person out of there. There's other means that God does that, and that's what the rest of the book of 2 Peter, which we're not here to expound on, but that's kind of what the rest of the book of 2 Peter is about this kind of lifestyle. And that lifestyle, by the way, when you get down into the next chapter, in chapter 3, the very way they excuse that kind of lifestyle is, what do they have to do? They have to, in verse 3, they have to be mockers that mock following their own lusts, because they say, where's the promise of his coming? Since the fathers fell asleep, everything's always been the same. See, this is the way you excuse yourself. There was a man that, if I remember correctly, died the same November 22nd, 1963. What happened on that day? JFK died. Because we just finished reading that book. JFK died. But there were two other men that died that same day. No. Lee Harvey Oswald died 3 days, three letters. Two other famous people, C.S. Lewis and Aldous Huxley. Aldous Huxley was a philosopher and a writer on philosophy and culture. And Aldous Huxley was an avowed atheist. And Aldous Huxley actually talked about, I think if I remember correctly, is the writer of, and I'm going to have to go back and check this because I'm off the top of my head here, but I believe he wrote the book Brave New World. And really, Aldous Huxley had the idea that there's a brave new world because we are becoming free of the constrictions of religion and God. And by throwing off the shackles of religion, we can finally be the people that live in this unrestrained lifestyle that we were meant to live. And we're using religion and the fear of God to make us behave. And that's not the way we ought to be. We ought to be good people. But we can be good people and just enjoy everything and be unrestrained. That's what he was basically saying. I mean, if you don't have a lot of moral rights and wrongs, apart from you don't hurt another person in his mind, then how are you doing anything bad if you live unrestrained? You know, that's the way he lived. Isn't it interesting that he died that same day that JFK died and the same day that C.S. Lewis died, and they died in that time. Anyway, there's a relationship to that with a book that I read many years ago, which is neither here nor there. But Aldous Huxley was a person. I always think of him when I come to this mockers that mock. Because in his mind, if you can get rid of God, you know, then we've done away with the constraints on culture and society. Okay. And there's still people, obviously, that think that way. But see, God knows how to deliver the righteous. And you and I, and we always need to remember that. We're always going to be in a culture. There's no way you're going to have a culture that's ever going to be ultimately really positive towards God, because it's always fallen. But that culture sometimes can be less hostile towards God than in other times. And it's when those cultures become that way that God has historically stepped in. And again, not just, we demonstrated this last week from Acts, not just in the Old Testament, even today. The focus of God's work is the church, but there are times that God has stepped in and ended political regimes, countries, nations, things of this nature. Now,
he could even rescue us by allowing us, I mean, I guess from a human standpoint, we weren't rescued because they tortured us and killed us, but in a way, it's like Paul said, he was going to be rescued from every evil deed. You know?
And he uses the same word.
Yeah.
He uses the same word.
By death, even. So the right. Humans may think, well, we got him, but God's perspective, he rescued us. Huh?
Now turn over to Matthew 24, because I want to do a little bit comparison here to their situation and different things that will happen. Matthew chapter 24, this is Jesus speaking on what is popularly called the Olivet Discourse, because he gives it while he's sitting on the Mount of Olives. It says, Jesus is making the statement in verse 37 of Matthew 24, "For as in the days of Noah, thus it will be in the coming or the presence of the Son of Man." In other words, when I return, what was going on in Noah's day is going to be the same. "For as they were in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage." So you got guys that are marrying and giving in marriage. That's women, because they're given in marriage. That's the idea. And it was that until the day Noah entered in the ark. In other words, they weren't all standing around waiting. "Oh, no, judgment's coming. We didn't get in the ark." No, right up to the day Noah gets in the ark, they're all there. And they're just carrying on life as usual. And Jesus is saying, that's the way it's going to be when he comes back. Those people really aren't expecting judgment. They weren't expecting judgment in Noah's day, and they're not going to be really expecting judgment at the hand of God or Jesus Christ when he comes to mete out judgment. They're going to be thinking everything's fine, and they just keep on eating and drinking and carrying on marriage and giving in marriage. Now, I will give you my one thought on the very fact that he mentions marriage and marrying and giving in marriage. I'm going to mention this. If you disagree with me, I won't argue with you, because I brought this up way back when I was in seminary, because it hit me. But what was significant about marrying and giving in marriage in the days of Noah? It involved the Nephilim.
Yeah.
It involved angels and the Nephilim, which I've just, every time I come to this and read that, that always stands out, and I'm always thinking, are they going to resume that? Are angels going to begin having children with women again, and you're going to start having Nephilim again in those days? And I've had people go, people that believe in the Nephilim, they believe in everything we talk about, but they look at this and they go, "I don't think that's what it's talking about." But I'm always like, why does he mention marrying and giving in marriage? Especially in connection with the days of Noah. Because that was the issue. That was one of the big issues in Genesis 6. I'm just saying. There's a very real possibility. This isn't the rapture, by the way. This is the second coming of Christ. This is not the rapture Jesus is talking about. So this is what's going to be going on even during the tribulation. So even when Christ is getting to come. And you think after everything that's gone on in the tribulation at that point, that by the time he comes, that these people will all be thinking, "Oh man, the end is near." No, even as they come down to the end, they're still not expecting the end. They're still thinking they're going to care. They're thinking they're just going to pick up life and they're going to go back to the way it was. We'll just get over this hurdle. We'll get over this thing. We'll get past this. This is the way they look at it. And we have parallels to this. Jesus mentions these things again, and there's parallels to this again that he says over in Luke chapter 17. But we're not going to go over and look at those. Turn back over to 1 Peter and turn to 1 Peter 3. We were in 2 Peter a little bit ago. Now we're in 1 Peter chapter 3. And Peter is encouraging his readers in here, where he's telling them, you know, it's okay to suffer. It's okay to suffer in the right way. He says in verse 17, "For it is better in doing good, if it is God's desirous will desires it to be this way. If this is what he wishes, for you to suffer than for doing wrong." If you do something bad and you suffer for that, what's that? He actually said that earlier in the book. But if you do a good thing and you suffer for that, then that's notable. And this is actually, three times Peter's essentially going to say the same thing. He's just going to keep changing the language, but he keeps talking about suffering. Verse 18, "Because indeed Christ once suffered for sin, a righteous one in place of righteous ones, that he might bring us to God. And having been put to death in the flesh, but being made alive in spirit, in which he also then, having gone, he proclaimed to the spirits in prison. Now, what are these imprisoned spirits that he was talking about? Well, it says in verse 20, the ones that disobeyed back when God's long-suffering was waiting in the days of Noah, while the ark was being prepared, in which a few, that is, eight souls, were saved through water. But verses 19 and 20 tell us that these were spirits, and that those spirits disobeyed, verse 20, when God was long-suffering during the days of Noah. Now, I believe these are the spirits that were those, these are those angels that were taking women and marrying them back then, and they were the ones that we just read about over in 2 Peter 2 that were actually confined to Tartarus. Actually, it's a verb form of the word Tartarus. They were Tartarist, is what it is. Now, I've read different men that have actually said, oh, no, you can't say that about angels going to Tartarus because that's Greek philosophy. No, it's not. You know what it is? It's Greek mythology. And you know why the Greeks had that? Because it did happen in history. And they actually developed a storyline that followed what had happened according to the Bible. But because they wrote it, they think, oh, it's no. The Greeks got it from what God actually did. Okay? And that's where this came from. And God did take. Now, obviously this means not all the angels that went with Satan were involved in that. Some of the angels did, but not all of them did. But when they did, they disobeyed. And it tells us in verse 19 that Jesus went, and most of your Bibles say, preach to them. And we've got all kinds of ideas about what preaching means, but all the word preach means is to go and make an authoritative proclamation. In fact, the best way to always think about, the best way to really think about what that word proclamation means is if I am given a message from, let's say the president gives me a message, and I go and meet with the president, and the president says, here's the message, I want you to go back and tell the people in your city this. Now, I could come back and I could try to paraphrase that message. I could try to put it into my own words. I could try to put a different spin on it. But chances are, you don't want what I think about the message. You would actually want to know, what did he actually say? That's what you want to know. And that's really what's behind that Greek word preach. It meant you communicate the message that was entrusted to you. And you communicate it accurately. It's not about theatrics. It's not about pulpit pounding. It's not about crying. It's not about acting. It's about accurately saying what the person that commissioned you told you to say. That's what that word meant. And what Jesus goes and does is he goes and makes a proclamation to these spirits. Now, was he given that proclamation from somebody else, or is he doing it on his own behalf? That I don't have the answer for. I tend to think he's making this on his own behalf. But what he's saying is accurate. And I'm only going to suggest what he says to these spirit beings. But I think essentially what he's telling them is, what you tried to stop, I have just finished. Now, I don't know that that's what he said, but think about that. Had Noah, the only righteous one in all those generations, had Noah become involved with those angels, there wouldn't have been a pure human being left. They all would have been corrupted with these angels, because it said all flesh had corrupted its way. So everybody else was involved in this. And they would have been stopping the descendant of Eve that God had promised way back in Genesis chapter 3 was going to bruise the head of the serpent with his heel. And they would have stopped that, because now that line would have been corrupted. It wouldn't have been just men. It would have been progeny of men and women, or men and angels, humans. Now, I don't know that that's what Jesus Christ proclaimed, but I believe that that's probably something to that effect. I have defeated you. I have accomplished what you set out to stop. And I think that they did try to do that. I think they have tried to stop. I think Satan did that in tempting Christ. I think that's exactly what Paul indicates in 1 Corinthians chapter 2. when he tells us that if those spirit beings would have known what they were accomplishing, they wouldn't have crucified the Lord of glory. They didn't. They thought they were stopping God's plan by moving those events. But in reality, they accomplished God's plans. So all along, Satan has always been trying to manipulate events to prevent God from accomplishing what God said he was going to do. And I believe that this was another instance of it. There's a comparison here to baptism. In here, this is anyway, I don't want to get caught up in that. Okay, I had a note on that. I don't know why, but I really didn't want to. Got caught up when I was writing my notes. But again, if you go back over to 2 Peter in chapter 3 and verse 3, which we already referred to once, but I want to go back and refer to it again. It says, knowing this firstly, that in last times mocking mockers will come, and they will come according to their own lusts. They have their cravings, and they're going to mock. Isn't this interesting? The very first century, the Apostle Peter told us, there are going to be people that are going to be coming. I know, I think this has been going on for most of the history of the church, but this isn't something that we should be shocked at when people mock Christianity. I don't know if you know who Ken Ham is, but Ken Ham's with... is out of Australia, and see, I'm not going to say it. Is he with Answers in Genesis? I always wanted to know if he's with that or Christian Research Institute. But they put in a Creation Museum out in Kentucky. And last night, out there at their Creation Museum, he debated Bill Nye the Science Guy.
Oh, wow.
And they did that because Bill Nye the Science Guy had got on his blog or on something online. He says, parents, quit foisting your foolish religious ideas on your children, telling them that this world didn't evolve. You're ruining your children by telling them silly stories about God in this. Now, I don't know that Bill Nye doesn't believe in God or anything like that, but Bill Nye definitely is an evolutionist.
He doesn't believe in God.
Okay, I didn't know that. But these two had a debate last night. And I got online and I read a little bit about it. I didn't listen to the debate. I guess it's on there and you could listen to it and I could read about it.
45 minutes, I think, is
really?
Wow. YouTube video, yeah.
And the people I said they didn't think it was the best debate they've ever seen because it was almost like these guys had presentations and got up and gave presentations rather than actually debating. But that was their appraisal. But having said that, I've read debates like that, and I've listened to creation evolution things. You know what happens to me when I listen to creation evolution debates? Number one, I get frustrated with the creation guys going, oh, don't use that argument. Oh, that's not a good one. This is a better one. I do that, and then I listen to the evolutionists. I'm going, oh, man, you just make me so mad. And I get so angry listening to the things that they say and how they, you know, can so attribute God's great work to natural forces.
You know, he said that a long time ago, like a couple of years ago.
Bill Nye.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And so one Sunday afternoon, Ellie asked me a question. I can't remember exactly what she asked me. She said, oh, let's look it up on the internet. And so we actually went to one of those Bill Nye the Science Guy thing, and he had this little thing made just for kids. That says he has, like, they're baking a cake, and they have some eggs, and they have some flour, and we know what man's made of, and we just have to get it together and the right ingredients, and then it's like baking a cake. You have a man. You know, you throw this eggs and flour together, and then you have a cake. Well, you get the right...
I could sure use a little more frosting on me.
Well, so, you know, Ellie, what do you think of that? And she said, well, I just wonder where the eggs and the flour come from.
Yeah, there you go.
It's so simple.
Yeah, yeah.
Even a little kid can understand it.
Yeah.
That there has to be something more to it.
Yeah. Well, and see, one of the questions that somebody posed to him last night is, where do the atoms come from? and the subatomic particles. And he goes, well, that's something science is still trying to figure out. Mm-hmm. See?
In other words, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, they don't.
And the, I don't know if you ever saw that thing called the Expelled or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
And it, the scientists are saying that since DNA, they absolutely know that evolution is an impossibility. But,
yeah.
So it is, you know, it's, I don't know why you get angry. I think it's,
I get
so much prevalent that they have a face.
I think it's funny that they have to believe their thing about the atoms and that by faith, that they're correct. And they're saying that we're stupid because we
believe by faith.
Yeah.
I think it's just a hilarious argument.
They're obviously blinded because it doesn't make any sense. And intellectually, I mean, it really, it's just stupidity to believe that it all happened by accident. Like, we've got this video series by, ironically, it's from Answers in Genesis, but my sister got it for the kids about the body. And there's a guy, Dr. Menton. The guy is brilliant. I mean, he goes through the body and how it's all put together, and he was just talking about the cilia in your lung tissue, you know, the little hairs that sweep the mucus up, you know, and keep things moving, and how the complexity of it, how they have to just move in such a rhythmic motion to, and they can't do that in mucus because it's too viscous. The hairs couldn't do it. So the way God made it, there's a little layer of water right along where the hairs are, and then the mucus rises along the top. So just the tips of the cilia hairs brush this mucus in this rhythmic fashion to keep it out. I mean, just, he said, just that alone. Because he said, people ask me, how do you give me evidence that there is a God? He goes, I can just show you just that one little thing in the human body. That's all I need. I mean, mm-hmm. He said, just look all throughout all of creation. That there's evidence everywhere. But mm-hmm. I guess they're just spiritually blinded, so they've got to come up with an alternative.
Well, what's really interesting to me is that they call us morons, but their father is the father of lies. God's word calls them morons, and he's the God of truth that sees things as they really are.
And one of the things that was mentioned in that last night when they did this, and I come across this, listen to these guys once in a while, is that they always make the point, creationists are keeping us from doing good science. And I want to know, why is that the case? There are medical doctors and researchers, Peg's got her brother-in-law is one of these guys, that's been doing research, and they firmly believe in creation. And it doesn't affect one iota your research. There's one goal in the end, ultimately, to pursuing that. And it's what Peter's saying here. They want to mock God because they want an excuse for living a certain way, for being unrestrained. That's what they want. That's their goal.
I was trying to access that last night, but I couldn't get it. But I did click on a little excerpt from the guy that brought MRIs into existence, and he is a believer. And he said, this says that a believer can't do science. Well, I invented the MRI, and I'm a believer. It was really cool.
Yeah. Actually, so God invented it.
Saying
he just discovered it.
Well, saying just what you just said.
Yeah.
There's lots of believers out there that are doing.
And they're doing good science. Yeah, they're really working on such. Because what they're doing is they're focusing on real science. They're focusing on science where you can do an experiment and you can repeat it again and again and again. The one thing you can't do with the whole study of evolution is you can't watch it repeated. So you can't test it. It's a non-testable hypothesis, is the situation. They're trying to find ways to test it. They're trying to figure out how they can take the flour and the eggs and put them together and combine them. They've been doing that for a long time, trying to figure out how to put those together and create some sort of a life. They can't do it. They get close. They go, wow, we almost did. But it's not actually alive. But
it's,
yeah. But it goes back. Our main point, I didn't want to get too off on this, but this is an interesting tangent to chase here on this, is the main reason that they hold to this, is, as Peter says here in 2 Peter 3, is that they're mockers. And I was using the illustration in the first place because I get really upset with these guys when I listen to them. I mean, I can listen to them for a while, but there's a point at which I'm like, these guys just really hate the idea of God. And it just burns me. I don't know why I should expect anything else out of them, you know, but it can get to me that way when you hear the way they're so against it. But it's Peterson right here. This is where they are. They mock. They mock the whole concept that there's actually a God that intervenes. And what Peter ends up saying, what Peter ends up doing in this passage is indicating that these men, when you let this go on unrestrained in the church, out there in the world it's going to happen, but if you let it go on unrestrained in the church, it does have a negative influence on the conduct of people. I mean, if every week I got up and was telling your kids, you know, I don't care what your mom and dad are, of course you guys wouldn't be here very long if I started doing that, but if I started telling your kids every week, you know, God, Jesus Christ probably is not coming back, so, you know, whatever you want to do, you know, don't get too caught up in your mom and dad's morals and all that. You know, you got to figure it all out for yourself. Whatever is good for you, you know. And I started doing that. You guys would probably be on. But if you were stupid enough to stick around, let's put it that way, what would that do? It would potentially interfere. And that's what Peter indicates in here. That's why Peter is actually telling these people, you need to deal with this. You need to know about these false teachers that are coming in, because that's what he's talking about from back in chapter 2. False teachers that are going to come in, even denying the very Lord who bought them. And he goes through and he gives these examples from history and then come over here and talks about these mockers. See? There's more. In other words, when we come down, is there is more about the story of Noah, Babel, and Sodom and Gomorrah than just that there was an ark, a tower, and a violent city. It was a whole mindset that Peter is telling you over here in the New Testament has been perpetuated throughout history, and it's still going on, and it has the potential to have a negative effect on you as a believer. And so, yeah, you can't fix the world. You can't make the world change. So even though I get upset at that going on out there in the world, I'm not going to invite it into the church. I'm not going to invite it in here and say, we'll tolerate you want to teach a class on this and you want to present your views on these things. We're not going to do that. We're not going to allow that. We're going to stand for what the Word of God says on these matters because of how it affects them. Okay, let's see.
Despite how I think the Word of God is very clear about that the angels came down and intermixed, but if you say that out loud, even there are people who don't believe that and are shocked when you even say that, and even people who have been taught it, they don't. They do not believe it.
Yeah. Because
we just don't know it from experience. You think, well, that couldn't happen. You know?
So it sounds like something some false cult would start teaching, and there's got to be something in there to try and deceive me somewhere, because it sounds weird.
But it's repeated in multiple places.
Well, I'll give you an example. The view that what we were teaching tonight used to be taught years ago at Dallas Seminary. I don't know. There may still be some teachers that hold to it at Dallas. But long about the 60s and the 70s, that view went out down at Dallas. And the view that then was they were encouraging guys to teach is, well, that these sons of God were actually arrogant regional rulers that, you know, were kind of forming clans and going around and just raiding and taking whatever women they wanted and doing these things. And this is what they were. And I'm like, how would that have been such a big whoop-de-doo? In this, I mean, it could be because they could have been violent men like Sodom and Gomorrah.
If
but
they were,
but it's,
then how come it says those angels were in Tartarus?
I know. Well, see, they look at that and they say it's completely unrelated. Is their argument that they're using? I'm just saying this is what they do. The other view that's been held also is that the sons of God are referring to the descendants that came through Seth, and the daughters of men were the descendants that came through Cain. Because remember, Abel dies apparently without progeny, so they have Cain, and then they have Seth, and Seth is the godly line, and Cain has the unclean line. The problem is, it's the sons of the godly line, that's why they're called sons of God in that view, marry only the girls of Cain. You don't have any guys from Cain's line taking girls from the Seth line? I mean, there's some inconsistencies in that too, that view. But that was the view, I think that was one of the, I'm not for sure, but I think that was one of the views that ended up in the Scofield Reference Bible, or maybe the Revision or something like that. But I'm just saying, so we're talking about people that are our friends, people that we would join hands with and say, you know, we believe what you believe. But they come to this, and they're so offended by this. And yet I'm thinking, as Jim says, that's too weird. Sounds like a cult thing. But you know what else we believe? We believe that God actually came down and walked the earth as a man and walked on the water and healed and raised some people from the dead. And he himself was killed, and he raised from the dead. Wait, that's too crazy. That's too fancy. Well, how is it any different than this then? See, we don't say that. We accept that as being true. So if you can accept that as being true, if you can accept the fact that God actually flooded even the earth and had Noah build a boat and saved all these people through that, that God could confuse the languages about, if God could do that, then these angels could have done these things. There's a number of scriptures that they use. They say the angels don't marry or give in marriage. It says the angels of God in heaven, yeah, they don't marry. It doesn't say these fallen angels haven't ever taken to doing it. And they did it, remember, not just in Genesis 6, but they did it afterwards, because it said they were in the earth then and also afterwards. So when Israel went in to take the land, they were in the land in those days. In fact, David went up against who?
Goliath.
Who was one of them, and how many brothers did Goliath have? Four. So there were five boys, and they were all big boys. That dad had a basketball team. They were all starters. Sorry, I shouldn't mock the scriptures. I'm not trying to mock them. I shouldn't make fun, Jess. Anyway, okay. There we go. I think that we've covered just about everything that we wanted to cover. This tonight was kind of covering some extra things. So next week we'll put in with looking at God's big promise, and we'll start looking at. We've got a few studies we want to do on God's promise to Abraham and then how God protects that line and things such as that. So, anything else to add or ask? Okay. Father, we are thankful that you are the God of these big stories, because you are the God that is bigger than anything that we can comprehend. And, all of these things, creation and these works, these things that you have accomplished and these things that you have done are just small exhibitions of your power. They're very mighty and very impressive to us, but from your point of view, they're just a modest exercise of your power as God, because your power is so grand and so great that it hasn't been taxed. And we're thankful that we can know that. And we're thankful, Lord, that your word is so plain and so clear as we look at this, that we can appreciate your intervention in history and the fact that that intervention hasn't ended. We know for sure you will intervene again in the future. And there's a time coming in which we won't be here to observe it, but we will be with you. And help us to anticipate that, and help us to remember then that we are in a time when there are people that are mocking. But we as believers can have a proper attitude towards who you are and what you've done and what you've provided, so that we don't have to be influenced by them. And we thank you for this. Amen.